Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. When you consider the impact of gerrymandering, attempts by state legislatures to more carefully control who votes, Supreme Court decisions on the outcomes of presidential elections, and more, you might think that citizen participation in voting is being tightly controlled, minimized, or even threatened. But Joshua Douglas is optimistic about the future of electoral politics. He is a professor of law at the University of Kentucky and the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. He's examined steps being taken by local activists who are making progress on expanding voting rights, and he sees reason for hope. So, in advance of his appearance Saturday at 2 p.m. at Park Road Books, we invited Joshua Douglas to explain his optimism and share some of his ideas about the electoral process. And he joins us this morning from Lexington, Kentucky. Joshua Douglas, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Mike.
You wrote in the LA Times that, quote, despair seems the common mood of the day, that U.S. democratic norms have devolved so much that it seems impossible to know how to recover. The whole system, you say, feels rigged against the majority of Americans. Is it?
Yeah, I think that's the common sentiment among so many people, is that, you know, when we hear about the right to vote, we hear about voter suppression, we hear that it's harder to participate, that apathy is taken over. And, you know, you just talked about the election there yesterday with less than 10% turnout. And I think the results, just in terms of our turnout numbers, demonstrate that we are in very many ways a crisis when it comes to participation in our elections.
But is the system rigged, or is that just an inaccurate perception?
Well, it is in many ways with respect to some of the structural forces that dictate how elections are run and therefore dictate who's in the electorate. And I think, you know, we can talk about rigged in a couple different ways. One, with respect to laws that make it harder to participate, or, as you mentioned, gerrymandering, decide who's in particular districts, which really dictates the outcomes in many places. But also, I think we can talk about being rigged with respect to voter apathy and this feeling that, you know, my vote won't really matter, so why bother showing up and participating, that the system has already decided who's going to win.
Hmm. Well, let's start with one of those impediments to voting that some people see as an impediment and some do not. Voter ID. That's something that voters just said yes to in November in North Carolina in a constitutional amendment referendum. A lot of people view the efforts by state legislatures around the country to require voter ID as efforts to control who votes or does not vote and to choose the people most likely to vote for them in order to maintain political power. How do you see these efforts to have voter ID put in place?
Well, I think you first have to decide or consider the kind of voter ID that you're talking about, because voter ID laws do come in all different shapes and flavors. And the question is, how strict are the laws? That is, what kinds of IDs actually suffice? But I do think that what we've seen in places like North Carolina and Wisconsin and Texas is a push for strict photo identification laws that have interesting carve-outs as to what kinds of IDs suffice. And they're really in an effort to make it harder for some people to participate with no corresponding benefit. You know, the ideal behind voter ID laws is that it helps the integrity of the election process. But the only kind of fraud that a voter ID law would prevent would be in-person impersonation, someone showing up to the polls and pretending to be someone they're not. And that simply does not happen to any significant degree. And so it's a solution in search of a problem that does have or at least can have a disenfranchising effect on some segments of the society.
So when people who are proponents of voter ID, for the reason you just mentioned, that it will stop voter fraud, which is rare, if ever, in terms of the number of occurrences that have taken place over the years, do they sincerely believe what they're saying, or is that just a cover story for what their real motive is?
Well, you know, I can't speak to anyone else's motivations, but I do think people are sincerely concerned about voter fraud because there's this frenzy among, you know, the media, the elected officials that talk about voter fraud all the time. They peddle these stories, you know, of, oh, I've heard of people voting multiple times. You had the Secretary of State of Texas come out with allegations of massive voter fraud and non-citizen voting, only to walk it back a week or two later once the evidence showed it wasn't there. And then you get the situations like you all just had in the 9th District in North Carolina where, you know, election fraud did change the result or had the election thrown out. Election fraud like happened there has nothing to do with the kind of voter fraud that people think a voter ID law might prevent. But people sometimes don't press upon the nuances and understand that a voter ID law wouldn't have done anything to prevent that kind of election fraud.
We have a tradition of voting that stretches back in this country hundreds of years, and yet we still argue about who can vote, who should not vote, who cannot vote, and what requirements have to be met in order for a person to be eligible to cast a vote. Why haven't we gotten this down to a science by now? Why are we still debating this?
I think it's because people recognize that who votes changes electoral outcomes. And, you know, the modern era of the voting wars, as one scholar has called it, started after Bush v. Gore in 2000, where election operatives really understood that election laws could dictate electoral outcomes. And so you have this push among people to try to change the electorate and restrict the electorate these days, you know, with things like voter ID laws. I mentioned, you know, the strictness of some of the laws. In Texas, for example, it's pretty clearly carved out to harm certain segments of society. It's a strict photo identification law, but a student's ID issued by the University of Texas, a public university, does not suffice, although one's gun license does suffice for voting. And so I think what we see is the Texas legislature promoting these laws understands the effects that they can have. And they're not massive effects. You know, most people do have an ID. But in Wisconsin, a court found that about 10% of the eligible electorate would not have an ID that would suffice. And so, you know, most people, it's no big deal. And, you know, you hear the common argument, well, I need an ID to board a plane or to buy alcohol or what have you. But the reality is that for a small but important segment of society, they are going to be harmed by the need to obtain the ID, perhaps get the underlying documentation like a birth certificate from another state. And this restricts the electorate. And to answer your question most directly, people understand that restricting the electorate can change the outcome.
Yeah, the voter ID laws and the one that you mentioned in Texas seem to be pushed everywhere by Republicans. And it seems to me that in Texas, the Republican legislature looks at these people who carry gun licenses and sees them as most likely Republican voters. But students whose student IDs cannot be used may be more likely, at least because of their youth, to be more liberal and therefore Democratic voters, and they want to not have them vote. I mean, we live in a country that likes to brag about its democracy while we subvert that democracy in some cases. Why? Is this just politics?
I think in large part it is politics, but this is not something new. You know, our history of voting rights has always been a push and pull between voter expansions and voter contractions. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about something like voter registration laws. Those came about after World War I when there was a massive anti-immigrant sentiment, essentially, and we didn't want a bunch of non-citizens voting. And you see those kinds of same arguments being made today. Unfortunately, anytime you talk about either voter restrictions or voter expansions, politics seems to enter the conversation. My own view, however, is that let's let everyone vote who's eligible to vote, and we should have an expansive view of who should belong in our democracy, and let the chips fall where they may. Let's let the best ideas and the best candidates win out and not the election rules. But too often, the election rules at the margins can have can make a difference.
Well, that sounds very idealistic, and it sounds very American, your philosophy of voting. And I think in the abstract, most people would say, yes, absolutely. But then they become a partisan, and they say, well, I'm not sure about that. Why do we let our ideals slip away?
Well, I think, again, it's because the stakes are so large often when it comes to the winners and the shape of our country. But I do think there are some bipartisan solutions to make it easier to participate and to bring more people into the political process. And we're seeing some of those successes around the country. And so, you know, some of the reforms I talk about, people say, well, they have a clear partisan valence and that'll never pass in a so-called red state. But some of the other ones have already seen successes in both so-called red and so-called blue places. And so I think we can build upon trust in, you know, getting more people to participate. And again, let the chips fall where they may. That is the American ideal, and it's something that we should aspire to. We shouldn't just be throwing up our hands and saying, well, the system is rigged. No, let's actually work towards these positive solutions.
So here's the three-part question. How do you view, how do most people view, how does the Constitution view voting as a right or a privilege?
Well, that's a loaded question in and of itself, of course, because in many ways, there's no difference, whatever semantics you use between a right and a privilege. But if we want to make that kind of distinction of a right being something that you inherently have and a privilege something you have to earn, well, of course the right to vote is a right. You know, we don't call it the privilege to vote. There's nothing you have to do besides being a citizen and obtain the correct age to be allowed to exercise the right. The problem is we start hindering it and putting burdens on it. But it's something that exists without you doing anything besides your very existence as a citizen of a particular age. Now, the Constitution, interestingly, is a little bit more silent on this question, the U.S. Constitution, because it doesn't actually confer the right to vote. It does so sort of in the negative. It says a state may not deny the right to vote to certain categories like race, sex, age over 18, inability to pay a poll tax. But state constitutions, including North Carolina's, do affirmatively grant the right to vote in explicit terms. And in fact, 49 of the 50 states have a provision in their state constitution that says voters here are eligible voters or shall have the right to vote. The only one that doesn't is Arizona's, and the state's courts there have understood its state constitution to confer the right to vote as well. So I think we can safely say that actually all 50 state constitutions demonstrate there's a right to vote. And they don't talk about it in terms of a privilege to vote. And again, there are no hoops you have to jump through. It is a right to vote.
Joshua Douglas is a professor of law at the University of Kentucky and the author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Because there are efforts being put up around the country in certain areas to kind of prune the voting population, and by making voting more difficult in many different ways, we often have this feeling of doom and gloom about the future of democracy in America and about our voting rights. And yet, you say that there are lots of efforts around the country by activists all over the country on the local level working on voting rights reforms. How many of those people are working against what's going on in their own state legislatures?
Well, many of them. You know, many of them are having to work in our political environment against some of the more restrictive laws that are occurring. But, you know, take the example of voter ID that we just talked about. I profile in the book two organizations, one called Vote Riders and the other called Spread the Vote, and some activists with those organizations that are on the ground in places like Wisconsin working on putting IDs into people's hands. I believe Spread the Vote is involved in Charlotte and in greater North Carolina area as well. And, you know, the reality is that voter ID laws are probably here to stay. They do have public support. And they don't have to have a disenfranchising effect if we actually get IDs into people's hands. And so these people are bringing individuals to the DMV. They are working with them to obtain the underlying documentation. They're ensuring that they can have an ID that helps them in their everyday lives as well as on election day. So if you want to consider that working against a legislature. Sure, it is. It's working against the doom and gloom, but it's doing so in a positive way that's enfranchising more people.
But as these individual activists or small groups of activists work in various places around the country on various different aspects of voting in America, they're up against legislatures. They're up against Congress in some cases. They're up against the Supreme Court. They're up against some major corporations who have a lot of influence on elected officials. Can these small victories around the country add up to something significant?
I sure think they can, and we've seen that happen. You know, if you think about the women's suffrage movement, as just one example, that started at the local level. You had some localities that enfranchised women for school board elections and some states that authorized enfranchising women for either local elections or school board elections. And you started to see a groundswell of support. In the modern era, you can talk about ranked choice voting, a different way of electing individuals where instead of voting for one person, you get to rank order your preferences. This was actually used decades ago in places like Cincinnati, but the modern era started in San Francisco in 2002, thanks in large part to an activist named Stephen Hill, who I profile, another one of these democracy champions. And he got it passed. It moved to other places like Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota. And now, just last year, it was used in Maine statewide. And so you see reforms happening at the local level in some places that demonstrate to other localities and to other people that, hey, these things actually work to improve turnout, to improve the democratic process. They don't have to be necessarily partisan. And then they can spread to other places as well.
In New York, Nevada, Wyoming, and Florida, they have made it easier in recent years for felons to vote. And that's something that you say is being driven by everyday Americans. They're the main drivers of this. Why do you think that average Americans and not lawmakers are at the forefront of that movement? And why is that a positive move in your view?
Well, because it's not being driven by the lawmakers, because the lawmakers, in large part, as we mentioned earlier, are self-interested in dictating who can vote to help themselves win re-election. But the everyday Americans aren't as concerned about that. They're just concerned about making sure that people feel whole again, that, you know, these returning citizens who committed a felony have the chance to be part of society again once they've served their time and paid their debt to society. You know, I opened the book with a story about a guy named West Powell from here in Kentucky. Kentucky has one of the worst felon disenfranchisement laws in the country. It disenfranchises felons for life. And so West was disenfranchised. He had stolen a car radio from an auto salvage yard 25 years ago when he was 18 years old. He was caught and convicted, ended up serving a little bit of time in jail, got out and cleaned up his life. And 25 years later, he went to the legislature to tell his story. The legislature was considering an expungement bill to allow some low-level felons to get an expungement of their records. And, you know, one of the legislators in the room, a guy named Whitney Westerfield, the senator, said he was opposed to the expungement bill, that, you know, felons had committed a crime and they shouldn't get any leniency. But then Wes Powell told his story. You know, he explained how he had cleaned up his life. He'd opened his own computer repair shop. He did everything that was expected of him.
And let me stop you there because we have to take a break. We'll come back and get the conclusion of that story. And we'll talk about other topics with regard to changes in voting in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Joshua Douglas is our guest, professor of law at the University of Kentucky, author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. He'll be at Park Road Books on Saturday at 2 p.m. to talk about his book and sign it as well. You were talking just before the break about West Powell in Kentucky, a convicted felon who had served his time and wanted his right to vote restored in a state where you say has the most restrictive felon voting laws in the country. And he told his story to the legislature. That's where we left off. What was the outcome?
Yeah. And so, you know, one of the senators, Whitney Westerfield, who had said he was completely opposed to an expungement bill, changed his mind on the spot. Wow. He ended up texting fellow Republican legislators and saying, we need to get this done. And they did pass an expungement bill. And so Kentucky's law, the worst in the nation, became a little bit better because someone like Wes Powell was willing to speak up. And the kicker and my favorite part of this whole story is that Wes Powell did regain his right to vote back, and he hasn't missed an election since.
So this has happened in greater degree in New York, Nevada, Wyoming, and most recently in Florida. It's one thing to have your voting rights restored if you're a felon who has served your time, and therefore you've paid your debt, so-called debt to society. But there are those who believe that people in jail or prison should be able to vote. They were referenced by Dan Bishop, the guy who just won the Republican primary in the 9th Congressional District here in North Carolina. He said he was talking about liberals and their ideas of having prison inmates vote as being a very negative thing. Should they vote? Should people in jail vote? And if so, why?
Well, they do in Maine and Vermont. And I'm not sure anyone thinks democracy is broken in those two states. Prisoners also vote in various countries. And in fact, prisoners vote in most states before conviction, or at least allowed to, right? If you're in jail awaiting trial, you have not lost your right to vote in most places. And so you do still have the right to vote. So,
but if you're in jail because you've been convicted, shouldn't that be part of the punishment? You can't be a full citizen when you're in jail.
Well, that's the rub of the question, right, is for those who are convicted. And so I go back to, you know, where do felon disenfranchisement laws come from? What's the history and what's the current effect? And the history of them really comes from post-Civil War Reconstruction, where state legislatures, largely in the South, passed these laws to try to disenfranchise newly freed slaves. And if you look at the current effects, well, it disproportionately harms minority voters who are in jail. You know, you don't take away someone's citizenship because they've been they're convicted of a crime. You take away various rights, including various constitutional rights. So the question again becomes, where's the linkage between committing a crime and having, you know, to serve time in jail and the additional punishment of losing the right to vote, which is not actually part of someone's sentence. Now, again, I'm focusing on some of the positive stories of progress in places like Florida, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in terms of that broader question, as I said, Maine and Vermont already allow convicted prisoners to vote. And I'm not sure democracy is broken there.
You write about citizen activists and their attempts to lower the voting age, this time to 16. First, it went from 21 to 18. Now they're working to move it to 16. Is that a good idea in your view? And if so, why? How would lowering the voting age to that age help our democracy?
It is a good idea, at least at the local level. And there are a handful of localities that have lowered the voting age to 16 for their local elections. It started in Tacoma Park, Maryland in 2013, spread to a handful of other places in Maryland. Now it's spread to a couple cities in California for either local or school board elections. I know the Los Angeles School Board just authorized a feasibility study to look at lowering the voting age to 16 for school board elections. Why is it a good idea? It can create a whole new generation of engaged voters. Voting is habit forming. One of the biggest predictors of whether someone's going to vote is if they voted previously. And if you missed the first election when you're an eligible voter, you're much less likely to become a habitual voter later in life. But if we lower the voting age to 16, which is, you know, much more active time when you're in the supportive environment of schools and homes, we couple that with improved civics education, we can create a whole new generation of engaged voters.
If 16-year-olds could vote in Florida, what would the gun laws be like today after Parkland?
You know, I don't know, but I think we can see the Parkland students as great examples of people who were able to drive a national conversation about gun rights and, you know, were respectful, were mature. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest pushbacks I receive on this is, you know, well, they're not mature enough yet. So I looked into studies of psychological brain development and learned that psychologists say that 16-year-olds are actually developed for what they call cold cognition, or reasoned, slow decision-making, not heat of the moment. Mm-hmm. Your brains aren't developed for hot cognition or kind of impulse control things until about age 21 or maybe 24 or 25. But the Parkland students, I think, demonstrate how certainly a lot of 16-year-olds are perfectly mature to be able to engage in our political discourse.
Let's talk about gerrymandering, because this state is in the middle of this, as several others are, and our case is pending in the Supreme Court. In Michigan, the movement to reform redistricting started, you say, with one person's post on Facebook saying, "I'd like to take on gerrymandering in Michigan. If you're interested in doing this as well, please let me know." Well, people did let that person know, and that led to Proposal 2 in that state to establish an independent redistricting commission. Voters there said yes resoundingly to that last November. Did it have significant opposition?
It did. It had opposition from largely the political elite, those in power in Michigan. And it's still facing opposition. The legislature there is trying to cut the budget of the new independent redistricting commission that the voters just authorized. So we see this push and pull. And, you know, my proposals are for focusing on positive voting rights reforms, but we also have to push back against the voter suppression that continues, right? There's a dual-pronged strategy here. So it did have opposition, but ultimately the voters, you know, overwhelmingly passed the measure. And again, it was because of this single Facebook post by this woman, Katie Fahey, who had zero political experience beforehand.
And aren't these efforts to push back on something that was resoundingly voted in by voters in Michigan and elsewhere, are these not seen for what they are? Doesn't this hurt people politically when they push back on things that are clearly attempts to either suppress the vote or to shape the vote in a way that impacts you as a legislator or a politician favorably?
Well, they should be seen as blatant partisan power grabs because that's what they are. And, you know, ultimately it does require the voters to rise up. You know, the voters in Michigan passed this overwhelmingly. The legislature is trying to, you know, make it harder or limit it by cutting the budget. Similar thing is happening in Florida with respect to its felon reenfranchisement, the state constitutional amendment that was passed, and now the legislature is trying to undo much of that. And so ultimately, the answer is going to be come Election Day. We need to have higher turnout, even though the system structurally is harmful.
Some states have tried to limit early voting in terms of the numbers of early voting locations or the hours of operation and the number of days that early voting is allowed. Other states, like Colorado, have established vote centers, which allow people to vote anywhere in the county. They don't have to vote in their own precinct. They just go anywhere where a polling place is open and they can cast their vote. That's about to happen in California, I believe, as well. Is that because of citizens' efforts to make voting easier?
It is. You know, so vote centers in Colorado were started thanks to a guy named Scott Doyle. He was an engineer by trade and had a long career as an engineer. And then at the end of his career, decided to join the county clerk's office in Larimer County, Colorado, to help improve the operations of the office. And this was around 2000. And he noticed some voters during that election being turned away because they went to the wrong polling place. They'd gotten it wrong where they were supposed to vote, tried to go to the correct place, but the polls had closed by then. And he said, there's got to be a better way. And so he went home and he kind of sketched out a model of voting and he brought it to his boss, the county clerk, who said, well, you know, this sounds like a good idea. Why don't you run for county clerk and then try to implement it? And he did. And so now in Colorado, you can vote any vote center anywhere in the county, and they're all electronically linked. So once you check into one place, you can't go elsewhere. And the ballot that's printed is the ballot for your home precinct. Colorado actually has a dual system. They also have universal vote by mail. So every voter is mailed a ballot a couple weeks before Election Day. So it's really the ultimate inconvenience. And what do we see? We see higher turnout.
You just said something very troubling. In Colorado, this ability to vote anywhere in the county, and not just in your home precinct, is made possible because everything is electronically linked. Does that mean it's on the internet? And if it's on the internet, how can it be secure?
Well, no. I mean, it's a closed circuit that they monitor very carefully closely. So this is not internet voting.
Okay.
But we have electronic poll books already in many places without concerns of the integrity of the system. And people are extremely vigilant about this because of the concerns that you just raised.
In Washington State, in Oregon, in Colorado, you can vote by mail and you can vote at home because you can vote by mail. That increases, you say, voter participation. But does it protect against voter fraud?
Well,
or election fraud, let's put it that way.
Yeah, election fraud, exactly. That is a common concern, right? We see where we do see election fraud, it often has to do with absentee ballots, as you just saw in North Carolina. Here's the difference between a universal vote by mail or vote at home system and the system like in North Carolina. In a vote at home system, everyone receives a mailed ballot. So you know if you received your ballot, you know if you know your neighbors have received it and you haven't. So there's all of the vigilance is on the mailed ballots. And in addition, places like Oregon have hired forensic experts to teach poll workers or to teach election officials. They don't have poll workers, but to teach election officials about signature matches. So it's not just untrained poll workers that are matching the signatures. In a place like North Carolina, you have most of the electorate voting in person and some voting via absentee ballots. There's much less vigilance, and it's much harder to regulate, even to figure out, well, who requested an absentee ballot and who didn't. So actually, vote by mail, universal vote by mail, can improve the integrity of the system because everyone's voting the same way.
So we have vote by mail, vote at home, voting centers, something called automatic voter registration, where I believe if you get a driver's license, they sign you up to vote right there. All of those initiatives, though, appear to have happened in more liberal areas of the country. What are we to make of that?
Well, that's actually not entirely true.
Okay.
Vote at home or vote by mail is the same thing. Yes, it's in Washington, Oregon, Colorado, but also almost every county in Utah, all but one county in Utah, uses universal vote by mail. A handful of places in Arizona and New Mexico, I believe, use it. In terms of automatic voter registration, as you say, where the state automatically puts you on the voter rolls using the information it already has, this passed in Oregon first, but then it spread to places like West Virginia, places like Georgia, which I wouldn't consider the same politically as the places where it started. So those are actually reforms that I think there's bipartisan support because what does it do? It makes the election system a lot more convenient, a lot easier, and therefore can improve turnout for everybody.
When you make the election system more convenient, when you lower the voting age, when you're able to stop gerrymandering, et cetera, in places like that, you say that leads to more engagement of people in the system and in our democracy. Why is that good for the country?
Well, if we think of our democracy as the envy of the world, and we define democracy as we should as having the consent of the governed, then shouldn't the governed include everyone? Shouldn't the consent of the governed include as many people as possible? We're going to have better representation. We're going to have more buy-in for the strength of our democracy if more people feel like they have a stake in it. Mm. And so ultimately, I think improved turnout is important because it can signal the strength of our democracy and the feeling that we all have a part.
Congressional Democrats have advocated for legislation to regulate campaign finance, to end partisan gerrymandering, to mandate national automatic voter registration, to make Election Day a holiday for federal employees. All of those things were referred to by Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell as a, quote, Democratic power grab. He said corresponding legislation should be called the Democrat Politician Protection Act. That makes it appear to some that Republicans would like to limit voter participation because they know that they would lose if more people voted, while Democrats want to increase that participation because they know they'd win if they did. Is that accurate?
You know, I don't know, and I don't care, largely. I mean, for me, this is not about the partisan outcome. This is about making it easier for people to participate so that we can have a democracy to which we're all proud. You know, I wrote a piece for CNN responding to Senator McConnell, my home state senator, inviting him to my election law class, saying that I think he can learn something about the way the election process in terms of election laws is run. And honestly, if you're so concerned that limiting the electorate is going to make you lose, then maybe you should question the kinds of policies that, you know, and whether your ideals and your message is, you know, adhering to or attracting a widespread of voters.
The Trump administration is pushing for a question to be added to the 2020 census. Are you a citizen of the United States? It seems innocuous at first, just another way for the Census Bureau to count who is where and what and who they are. But you say that depending upon how the Supreme Court decides this case, it could impact the outcome of the 2024 presidential election. How so?
Yeah, that's right. Well, if this citizenship question is allowed to be on the census, then most experts believe that it's going to undercount certain areas, that places with a lot of non-citizens are simply not going to respond, even though they should be responding because they're fearful of governmental questioning about their citizenship status. Mm-hmm. And if you have an undercount in certain areas, that's going to dictate or change potentially the electoral college representation in certain states, because the number of electors one receives in the electoral college for each state is dependent on the number of people,
right,
and total people, not citizens.
So the bottom,
that could change the numbers.
The bottom line here is that citizen activism can have an impact, even though it's incremental. It can have an impact nationwide. Joshua Douglas, professor of law, University of Kentucky, author of Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.